social science field, they did not then have a discipline called sociology. Marxism was the substitute for it. They were very kind to him, and since he was interested in anthropology, they spent many hours telling them of their plans for the native peoples who had no language, who had no written language, and whose knowledge of the world outside of their own little communities was absolutely primitive. The plans that they had and the efforts that they made so impressed him that he became quite convinced that this was a world that he could support. This was a society that he could support. Furthermore, he was tremendously impressed with the developments there. It was a very hard time in the Soviet Union. There was not a great deal of food. But the people were very confident, and there was a great spirit of achievement and effort and love of the society itself among all the people that we met.
Did the party introduce you to people or give you names before you left?
Not on the first trip, but on the second trip. We went again in 1938.
Uh-huh.
But in 1932, it was largely an exploratory visit on our part and a sense of adventure that we wanted to see a new world and a new society. And I didn't ask for any contacts. However, when they found out what my special interests were, they did arrange to take me to some of the factories. And I visited, I recall, a candy factory. I had also met some friends there that I knew who were active in journalism. There were a couple of people that worked on the Moscow News, Americans, and they also were very helpful in getting me to see things that I wanted to see, especially how they ran their factories and how the trade unions operated. But I must say that the visit was short. We were there all together about 3 weeks.
And this was the time with Trotsky had just left. The workers' opposition was being
as far as the politics
down,
there,
yeah,
we were uninformed about the politics.
Oh, the trial.
The intellectuals who met my husband were very happy and jolly and felt that they had a home. And there was no criticism of the communist movement. We never met anyone who actually criticized the system or the government or any of the individual leaders.
Or bureaucracy.
And we came away without any feeling that there was a tremendous amount of turmoil going on while we were there. We just came away with a tremendous sense of the wonder of their survival and the importance of their achievement.
Uh-huh. Did you see Reed and those Americans?
No.
There?
No, they
were pretty discontent.
Not in 32. They were not there. I think Reed was
dead
by then. Yes.
We saw none of those
Americans, but we met some Americans who were helping, and we met some engineers who were working with the groups, and they took us to, I recall one very interesting experience in which we went to a summer home of the engineers. It was called the Engineers Dacha, and it was so primitive. We had to drink the warm milk that came from the cow without it being pasteurized. We slept in a hayloft, but this was a summer cottage, which was cared for by an elderly couple who had lived in the area for many years and who knew the environs, and who were supported by the Engineers Club, and the engineers would come out with their wives and spend weekends in the country, just loving the beauty of the scene, and. It was. I remember that we cooked our food over an open fire. It was very primitive. There were no hygienic facilities at all, and at times I was quite fearful that something might happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
I I insisted upon having the water boiled and even the milk boiled. And I was especially worried about my husband's health. But apparently we survived it very well.
How about women's things? Did you see now, any women's congresses efforts with women?
No.
Then they were
in the first visit. It was almost entirely a surface experience of just seeing things as they were, spending much time on the Red Square, talking with people on the streets who could speak English. We didn't speak any Russian. And when I visited the candy factory, I recall that there was a committee of women who received me, and we sat around after the visit to the factory, which, by the way, was a very old, primitive building that they had refurbished. I recall even now the beauty of the red geranium plants on all the windows, because they wanted to make it look like a not like a factory, but like a nice institution, a pleasant institution in which to work.
Was there a child care center there?
There was a crèche there, mm-hmm. and I visited that, and it was fascinating to see the children, how well they were cared for. But everything, it seemed to me, was on a very primitive level. And we had to, we accounted for that, for the fact that that the revolution was only 12 years
and old. Civil war,
and the war had just about ended at the time. There was very little food in the country. We managed all right. The tourists were given enough to eat, but it was obvious that the stores were quite empty of food. People were not well dressed. It was not the kind of society that was affluent at all. But the spirit and the confidence of the people that we met and saw was really very encouraging. And my husband was especially impressed with the attitude of the intellectuals, many of whom told him that they were not members of the party, but they had been allowed to function in their universities and so on. Later, when we visited the second time in the 30s, many of these people were no longer available to us. We couldn't find them. When we visited them at their homes, or when we went to visit their homes, we were told that they were out of town.
Mm-hmm.
They were unwilling to make any further contacts with us, although some of them had corresponded with us during in the interim.
Mm-hmm.
But the situation was then in the later visit was so tense that they were fearful of contacting foreigners. And I'll go on with that at a later time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We left the Soviet Union with a great deal of enthusiasm, and we went directly to Paris. No, we didn't. We went to Germany first, and this was just before Hitler had been returned to power. And we went back first to see the apartment in which we had lived during the period when my husband was ill and after his illness. And the place was deserted. It was the whole area looked different. It didn't have the same spirit, it seemed to be almost a deserted area. Of course, we lived in the Zoo section, which was a middle class, affluent section before Hitler, perhaps mostly middle class Jews. We were disappointed when we saw the place that we lived in, because we had perhaps glamorized our earlier experience, or perhaps not. Perhaps things had deteriorated. Then we went to visit the Marx House, and we were absolutely aghast at the situation there. This was the Communist Party headquarters that had been several times raided, and was now just an empty shell. They still had the sign up, but apparently everything had been moved out of the building. The building was empty. You could go into the building, in and out, and nobody stopped you. There were a few people who hung around, but the rooms were empty. There was an occasional chair, no furniture hardly to speak of. The place had been sort of destroyed by raids, and people were not talking about it, and it was very depressing. And we felt that a very serious development had occurred since our earlier visit to Germany, and that while we didn't understand fascism, we didn't know what its nature would be, we recognized that, that this was a result of great repression. And people who saw us would turn away, would not want to talk. People who saw us in the building, you see, and we went in and out of the building and finally gave up. And so, because it was so depressing, we stayed in Berlin only a couple of days and went right on to Paris to the conference. When we got to Paris, we found that we were both delegates, by the way, from Bernard from the Writers Union, and I from I suppose the Trade Union Unity Council. I don't know exactly I don't remember that very clearly. I don't remember how that was, but I know that we were both official delegates from the United States.
And did that mean that someone paid your way?
No. This was all voluntary. I mean, you did it on your own, but it meant that we could represent
and bring it back.
Yes, and we could bring a report back. I have the notes of that conference somewhere, and I might give it to you if I can find it in my files. It was very fascinating. However, the conference did not take place in Paris because Gorky had been invited as a speaker, and the Parisian authorities refused to allow him to enter. So within 2 days, the entire national conference was moved to Amsterdam. And so we went on with...
Who organized the conference?
Well, it was, I think it was sponsored very largely by the communist parties of the various countries. But it was called the United Front World Congress Against Fascism, you see. So it embraced, I would say, hundreds of people who were not communists at all, but who were fearful of what Hitler was going to bring to Germany. Mm-hmm. There was no very...
Socialists were cooperating?
Some socialists. I mean, we had, for example, in India, the socialists of India came. Patel, who was one of Nero's very close friends, was the delegate from India. The Americans were people like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Dana, and Sherwood Anderson, and a number of professors came, and then, of course, there were a number of people who were on the left. Margaret Schlapp was among them, Joseph Brodsky. Margaret, Joseph, and Bernard and I were the delegates.
Margaret Schlapp, who went to Poland.
That's
later,
right. Yes. Who was an Icelandic authority? I don't remember. Sanskrit authority. I believe that we were the four delegates from the United States. There were many, many people who were fearful of Hitler. One thing that struck us very much was the fact that the Russians didn't seem fearful of him. I don't think that the Russians understood really what he wanted to do. They recognized him as an arrogant, tyrannical, dictator of a sort, but they did not conceive of the kind of thing he would do. Mm-hmm. And therefore, with them, fascism was simply the extreme manifestation of capitalism. Mm-hmm. And when we who already in the United States were quite worried about Hitler, especially his attitude towards Jews, when we got there, we were quite surprised to find that the communists that we met did not think
the Soviet. What about the German communists?
Did not think them as serious. Even the German communists,
the
German communists who recognized that he was a danger to them and who had to go underground, didn't understand fully didn't understand fully what. Mm-hmm. What the significance of his of this development was.
So the United States.
But we felt we were in a sense ahead, and the British communists also understood better because they saw the manipulations of the British government, you see, with the West against the Soviet Union, and therefore they were very much more sensitive to the fact that this might be an effort to destroy the Soviet Union. They never saw it in relation to what it would do to the German people. They saw it more as a world danger to this fragile communist society in the Soviet Union. And it was fragile, you see, because of the fears of capitalism and the threat. The threat was very serious. There was constant conspiracy. So this, of course, was before the Spanish Civil War, too. Remember
right.
that, you see.
Right.
We were really very much appalled by this attitude. Nevertheless, it was a world conference against fascism. It was called that. And there were many discussions on the platform by very leading people from all over the world.
What about the Italians?
Well, I didn't meet them.
Oh.
But there were representatives, of course, Mussolini was already in power, you see. Mm. But Mussolini was not he was repressive against the communists, but not against the people as a whole. Mm. And they didn't feel it as, you know, they felt, well, it's an anti-communist regime and we have to be prepared for that, you see. So many of them were underground, but I don't recall exactly where they stood because I don't remember meeting them. My recollection of this conference was the various sessions which we attended, in which there was simultaneous translation, and then the fact that we would work in committees. So we worked with a committee of the British, the Americans, the Indians. I believe those were the three who worked together in one, because we were English-speaking, yes. And it was fascinating because we had to decide what kind of a resolution we would present, how it would be worded, and so on. And I recall that the night before the resolutions were to be introduced, we stayed up all night preparing the resolution. And Harry Dana and Bernard and Joe Brodsky were very active and formulating the theses that we wanted to present of the threat to the world, the world danger against communism.
Can you talk about women under fascism? And
there were a great many women delegates there, but the whole problem of women was never brought up, really. It was all merged. Everything was merged. The women and the men worked together mm-hmm. against fascism. That was our major theme, you see. And I recall that finally, about 3 a.m, I got so tired that we were in a hotel room that I went to sleep on a couch. And all I know is that when I woke at 5 a.m, everything was finished.
Were you worried about your child on your way at all?
Well, on the first visit, I was worried, but that was it was a month. You see, we were away uh-huh. for a month. Bernard had a month's vacation, and I was worried. I was concerned. I did uh-huh. very much want to see her. And but I got frequent letters from my sister-in-law. Uh-huh. However, when we returned home, we found that things hadn't worked out well. Mm-hmm. That my sister-in-law was in herself in a very traumatic state. Her husband was leaving her, and she mm-hmm. was very upset. And she and my mother failed to hit it off because my mother was so watchful over the child. And she was so permissive that they didn't have the same ideas about bringing up children. So my mother would on the days when my sister-in-law would take the baby out, she was only 13 months, right. you see, my mother would follow quietly behind the scenes and watch to see that the baby was not allowed to do things. You see, there was a park here,
uh-huh.
and she played in the park, and my mother was always very worried that she might pick up something or that she might hurt herself or something. So my mother was really terribly overprotective, and my sister-in-law was just the opposite, and they just didn't get along. When we returned, a very interesting thing happened. The child didn't recognize either of us. And then finally, when my husband took her in his arms, she cried. She burst into tears, and she cried for a whole hour. We couldn't stop her. She felt so emotionally deprived, I think, from our absence, that she wept, cried, and cried, and cried, and finally she was stilled. And she simply couldn't tear herself away from our arms. She went mm-hmm. from one of us to the other all the time. And we both felt that we had done the wrong thing in leaving her, that there was a deprivation emotionally mm-hmm. to her that we felt was wrong. And later in her life, we felt that some of the things that happened to her, or some of the things that occurred in her early life, had to do with this deprivation, this month's deprivation. It may not have uh-huh. been, but that was at least right. our way of explaining it. anyway, that was a very, very painful experience. And my mother was also terribly upset and cried a great deal because of my sister-in-law. And my sister-in-law, on the other hand, was very bitter and antagonistic to my mother. And told me afterwards that she just overprotected the child, which was wrong for the child. So, of course, we straightened that matter out. But our relations after that, my relations with her, not so much with the children, because mm-hmm. I loved the children, became rather strained. Mm-hmm. And over the years, they became more strained. In the meantime, my sister-in-law, by the way, had become had moved to Sunnyside. She was a Chicagoan originally, but she had moved to in Queens, and there she met some of the Communist Party members who were very dedicated and very loyal. And eventually, she became a party member and a very dedicated party member throughout her entire life.
So back to the Congress. Sorry.
Yes, back to the Congress. After the Congress, we had very little time left.
What did the Congress come out with statements?
Yes, the Congress was primarily a Congress to focus attention on the threat to the world of advancing fascism, Mussolini and Hitler, and also, of course, the danger to the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union felt that it was encircled, and it was encircled, and felt that perhaps Hitler would be the tool for the destruction of the Soviet Union, and of course it proved to be so. But at that time they didn't conceive of him as being the menace that he turned out to be.
Did you plan a program for what to do when you got back?
Well, we planned
States?
Resolutions, and we decided then that we would build United Front organizations mm-hmm. all over the world against fascism, and that was the beginning of the United Front in the United States. And when we got back, the League Against War and Fascism was established, and many of the writers who were supporting the Writers' Union at that time joined. And this was the beginning of my husband's change towards the communist movement. He had always been very skeptical about the leadership. He admired men like Foster and others, but he did not admire the younger group of City College students who tried to rule the roost and who were later, of course, dislodged and expelled from the party. And these were originally my friends. They had been the ones with whom I had spent most of my people like Bertram Wolf, who was, of course, who later defected. He's not a No, I don't really know what his role was, but he was very anti-communist.
Uh-huh.
I don't think he embraced Trotskyism either. But and then, of course, Jay Lovestone, who became a government agent, who was a CIA agent, probably a CIA agent even while he was the secretary of the Communist Party. But these were the people whom I first met in Boston and then later here in New York, and they were the ones whom I admired for their ideas and so on.
It wasn't
and
people like Gates.
No. Gates was later.
Gates and Charney.
They were later. They came later. These were the earlier City College people.
Oh.
And of course, among the people who were on the side of Wolf and Lovestone, of course, was Gitlow,
an agent too.
Who was a friend of Elizabeth Gurley Clinton's.
And he turned evidence, too.
I think so.
Yes,
I think
I remember.
Yes, they all were informers later. Right. They all turned out to be men of little loyalty, small men, the men who perhaps were attracted to the communist movement because it would give them an opportunity for leadership. And then became informers because they thought that they would get something out of it. They were unprincipled, mm-hmm. and
You didn't see at that conference really Soviet leadership that determined what you would do.
No,
you didn't
no.
get the idea.
At the at the international conference, the Soviet delegation was not terribly prominent.
Mm.
And as I say, they in their speeches, they never alerted us to what Hitler actually became, you see. And then as we came back in September, and Hitler was elected in October, you
right.
see.
Oh.
You remember that. And of course, Hindenburg approved. You know, Hindenburg was the one that did the finishing. It was the, laid the finishing touches to Hitler's election. And, of course, after that, we never returned to Germany. When I returned from that visit, I felt somehow or other that I had matured a great deal. I'd learned a lot, and I felt more confident of my own ideology.
Was it because Bernard had changed also, do you think?
Well, that helped. That helped a little, yes. That helped a little.
So there was a conflict there.
Yes, there was now much more of a consensus between us, you see, whereas previously we had been in conflict. But I think largely it was my own development, my own maturing into the movement. And when I returned, I had contacts. I had already broken away from the Lovestone Wolf. Cabal, and I had made friends among the leaders. I had known Foster, and I had known some of the other Jack Stachel, whom I admired very much. And also, I developed a very warm friendship with one of the leading communists, Alexander Trachtenberg, and this lasted throughout his life and my life. He was very
He was the international press.
He was the press. International publishers, the director of international publishers. He was very dedicated. He was cultured. He was a man who understood the intellectual as well as the working class. And he was a good bridge because there were very many sectarian communists who were... who looked upon the intellectuals as someone they had to use, but who were really in their way in a sense. And many of the working class communists were very dedicated, and on the other hand, many were quite ambitious and unscrupulous. There were many, and I found that I did not meet too many women whom I liked in the movement, for the simple reason that being at the top, so to speak, meeting all of the leading people in the movement, I saw the nature of the women who tried to achieve leadership within the party. And in order to be as good as the men, you know, and to cope with them, to compete with them, many of them behaved in ways that I didn't think were...
Like what?
I don't know how to put it. There were ways which I didn't approve
like what
of.
Kind of like what
well,
kind
for
of
example, they were very conscious of being women and having to cope with the men, and frequently they were snobbish. There was an elitism among them.
Mm-hmm.
There was a feeling that. That they couldn't really come down to the lower levels because they had to be on a political level with the top, you see. And it was an undemocratic, see, approach. Not that they were snobbish to me, but they certainly didn't welcome me because...
With competition?
Partly competition, partly that they thought I was an intellectual, although I came from a poor background. They thought I was an intellectual since I was married to an intellectual, and there was a general feeling in the party that intellectuals were not to be encouraged too much. That they could be used. That was the idea. They could be used for their skills, their special abilities, and so on. But they were not to be encouraged for leadership.
They were petty bourgeois.
That's right. There was an element of that. They were petty bourgeois. They were
Their class interests weren't sure.
Yes, exactly.
They might betray.
Yes. Well, they did. Many of them did betray. I mean, it started with
starting up again.
Yeah. It started with the disaffection of many of them because of the Munich Pact, and then many of them were critical of the methods that were used by the communists. There were all sorts of reasons why they joined with us in the beginning and then left us. First of all, they were fearful of fascism, and there was no other organization in the country that took up the cudgels against Hitler except the Communist Party. And therefore, they saw in that a life preserver of a sort for themselves. And in the beginning, they were very dedicated. They worked very hard. Among them was Granville Hicks and Dos Passos. Well, I don't know about Dos Passos. I never saw him in any meetings. But there were others. They were all active in the Writers' Union. Some of them were active in the election campaign of 1932 when
Roosevelt.
Foster ran.
No,
yes.
Not Roosevelt. The communists didn't back Roosevelt. Yes.
No, we ran our own. Yeah. Foster and Ford were our candidates. And they were active. Many of them signed petitions and worked very hard. And while they, during this early period of Hitler's rise, there was a very strong feeling among the liberal, progressive intellectuals that the communists were the only ones that were battling fascism. Later, however, many of them used the opportunities that were afforded to them by their misunderstanding of the Munich Pact to resign or to get out, and many of them became frightened and turned informers.
With the workers, did you organize with working people against fascism too?
Now, the American League Against War and Fascism, with which I was not associated, but my husband was one of the sponsors. He appeared on the letterhead. Did work very hard to get the middle class, intellectual, bourgeois, the petty bourgeois elements in the United Front, and for a while it flourished very well. Mm-hmm. There was great fear in America, just as there was fear everywhere, and especially among Jews.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back a bit to my friendship with Alexander Trachtenberg.
Right. Okay.
Trachtenberg was the man who encouraged me a great deal to write. Mm-hmm. And after my book, Labor and Lumber, had been published, he spent a lot of time with me. We would meet for lunch frequently. Telling me about his plans for the books that were being published at International, getting ideas and discussing them with me. He was a very much older man than I was, but very knowledgeable. He was a Yale graduate. He had experienced the 1905 revolution as a very young man. I think he was then a young student, perhaps in his teens. Had come to the United States and had been totally committed for many, many years to the socialist movement. And I learned a great deal from him. He was a sort of mentor for me.
Uh-huh.
And because he was so encouraging, you see, I did more writing, but I didn't really attempt to write anything very...
Did Bernard encourage your writing too?
Oh, yes, very much so. But he didn't. He was so busy, you know, that what he would do is he would suggest that I write something, and then he would go over it with me and help me with the editing, just
uh-huh.
as I did with him. You see, it was a sort of mutual thing. And after a while, when he became involved in writing as a means of earning a livelihood, it was very difficult for us to do anything together. I had always dreamed of our having a sort of partnership like Sidney and Business
right.
Webb, but it never worked out
uh-huh.
very well because of his interests and mine, and they weren't divergent. They were actually, they coincided, but they weren't exactly the same.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, I attribute a great deal of my knowledge and understanding of the movement to Alexander Trachtenberg. I thought he was a fascinating man. He was full of humor. He could laugh at himself and the rest of the party people, and at the same time be loyal. And that was a refreshing thing, because one didn't meet that too often among the leadership.
Yeah, Elizabeth Shirley Flynn had a lot of trouble with him. Yeah, she had big fights with him.
About her work,
her book,
yes. Well, they were both perhaps prima donnas of a sort.
Uh-huh.
He was very sure of what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently I had to battle him.
Uh-huh.
And then he was very loyal to his organization, so that he didn't give the writers any royalties or anything of that sort. The best he could do would be to send you three books or something after they were completed, you see, because money was a very serious problem.
Did you do for him? Did you work for him?
I didn't work for him,
mm-hmm.
but I met him, I would say, perhaps once a week or once every 2 weeks, all during the 30s for discussions. Mm-hmm. And finally, as a result of...
Just he and I.
Uh-huh. Yeah, just to meet. And I think he thought it was my part
uh-huh.
of his job to educate me. And then I started, at his suggestion, I started work on the Silvis book.
Uh-huh. Oh,
but that was already...
suggestion.
It was his suggestion.
Were you teaching at the school?
I was teaching...
Time?
Yes, I want to say something about that, too. I was teaching at the workers' school, largely through his suggestion. Yes. And I taught history of labor. And, of course, I studied a great deal during this period. And I had some very fine students. Many of them were students at Columbia who came to get courses.
Men and women?
Men and women both, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, many were working class people.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also conducted classes in various unions. I would perhaps go once a week to the Shoe Workers Union, where we would have a class in history of the labor movement.
What, and they would
and
be this, excused from the...
No, they would come after work. The workers would come after work,
but
after their shop.
Would the union arrange it?
The union would arrange it. The union would announce the class.
And they'd pay for the class?
There was no payment at all. This
they
was
wouldn't
part
give
of their
them
membership.
Time
but
back,
I,
though.
Well, they worked.
But they wouldn't give them time, say, off their work to go to the class.
Oh, no, because they were working for capitalist employers. They were working in big shoe factories.
But now they do give them time off to go
to study. No, there was no such thing. There was no such
uh-huh.
thing. The worker would come to the union at 6 o'clock in the evening,
uh-huh.
and he would probably have a very light lunch of some sort, and then at 7 we would start our classes and work until 9. And this was to raise the consciousness, the union consciousness, and the political consciousness of the workers. I had several such classes. I had classes in the Furniture Workers Union. These were all embryo unions. They were not really very powerful unions, but they were the
locals that you'd work with.
They were small local unions who were working to organize a shop or organize a department in a shop.
Were these the unions that the communists had influence?
These are the unions, and most of the people who came to these classes were communist sympathizers if they were not members, you
uh-huh.
see. And this was the core that built the unions, you see. And they were the ones who went out with leaflets and they organized in their shops. And finally, the Shoe Workers Union developed into a very fine union. By the end of the 30s, it was one of the big unions in the city. I also taught at the Fur Workers Union. I taught
Did you relate, when you taught, say, at the Fur Workers Union, did you think about what issues that were needed for them to be organizers and go back? Did you sort of teach the history from the present orientation?
No, I taught history more from the orientation of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
of what it meant to be a class-conscious worker in the United States today, you see, at that time. And I showed the history of labor and the struggles of the workers and the strikes. I went into quite some detail on why some of the strikes failed and then, on the other hand, why some of them succeeded. And this was all part of a development that these workers had no understanding of at all. And when they learned, for example, about the Haymarket case, or when they found, or the steel strike of 1919, or the Seattle general strike, which I was very familiar with because I had been there, they began to feel that they were
what for the shoemakers, the Knights of St. Crispin, was this militant shoemakers.
Yes, of course. Yeah, sure, sure. That was the time of the Knights of Labor and so on. Yes. I went all the way back, the way back, even before the American Federation of Labor. I started really from, I even gave them some American history along with American labor history, you see. And they were fascinated. I had wonderful attendance. There were always at least 10 in the group.
And you learned this on your own?
And I studied by myself with the info. I had access to the Columbia Library through Bernard, you see.
Did you have any help from anyone else?
No, I just made up my own courses and studied and prepared them. And those were the most rewarding things, going from one union to another. No, in fact, the leaders of the unions were delighted that these courses were being given.
Did they take the courses too?
Some of them used to sit in. Some of them used to sit in on them. But, you know, they had to be leaders. They couldn't very well descend.
Right. Was there any
So very often they would talk to the workers and ask them how they liked the classes. And oh, the workers were very enthusiastic. As a matter of fact, and it didn't cost the unions anything because I was a volunteer. I was just doing it as a laborer.
Was there any problem that you were a woman doing this at all?
No. I never experienced anything but respect from the male labor leaders that I contacted in the unions. There was a very profound feeling of respect for people who had knowledge, and I think that this was one of the earmarks of the leaders of the unions. I'm not speaking now of the party.
Right, the unions.
I'm speaking of the unions, because the leaders of the unions, for example, I remember one man who is now dead, I think his first name was Al Rosenberg, who was a genuine intellectual. He was a working man. He had worked all his life in the shoe plants, and he was the leader of the shoe workers union, and he built it to an enormous organization. It was a very big union at the end of the 30s, also CIO union, you see. But Rosenberg was a delight to talk to. He was a man who, he was an autodidact. He was a man who had great interest in intellectual things, in reading, in understanding world politics. And he was a remarkably astute politician. He knew American politics very well. These were men that I met.
And did they read a lot?